Blog Talk Radio.
The opinions and views expressed by the host and guest are not necessarily the views and opinions of the Blake Radio Network. Broadcasting to the world.
BlakeRadio.com. Music for your mind.
Good evening. This is Dr. Jennifer Daniels, and you're listening to Healing with Dr. Daniels on the Rainbow Soul Network. And today's topic is, how do you know what to believe? There's a question. I was inspired to do this show, this particular topic, because I was talking to a friend of mine that I thought was especially well-informed, and he was just coming up with all this bizarre stuff that just was factually unsubstantiated. And so I realized that there's a big issue out there, and how do you know what to believe? How do you know what sources to rely on? The truth of the matter, of course, is you really don't. Nobody can tell you what to believe. The best anyone can do, the best they can do, is to share their personal experiences with you. Not their beliefs, but their personal experiences. And the thing that I think helps the most is if you believe something, but it conflicts with your experience or observations, then you need to have the courage to reconsider that belief. That is so important. And I think that's fundamentally, that's the foundation of this question, how do you know what to believe? Of course, it's a false question. The answer is you don't believe anything. You constantly look for evidence and constantly revise what you think. But let's just take a look at healthcare and alternative healing. Usually I let the alternative healers off the hook, but tonight we're going to mention them. So there's so much information out there. And, you know, one thing we're hearing a lot about lately is Ebola. Is Ebola spreading? And that's what it tells us. It's spreading. Well, if it is spreading, how fast? And what should you do? And other natural therapies. And then travel vaccines, another issue that came up. So how do you know which vaccines to take? And how effective are the vaccines? And what about coconut oil? How healthy is it? Confusion. So tonight, I'm going to give you some answers. And I'm going to walk you through the process I use to decide. So think happens. But first, I have to tell you how I got involved in natural healing. Now, I told you part of the story, but here's the rest of the story. My patients were doing very poorly. They're doing so poorly with the standard of care I had learned in medical school that I made up my mind that I was going to go to the library, the medical school library, to see if there had been any research, you know, breakthroughs that would benefit my patients. So I went to the library, and lo and behold, the medical school library was a treasure trove of information on diet, supplements, and I tell you, overwhelmingly favorable, or what helped. And it very clearly stated how totally ineffective the therapy was that I was taught to use in medical school. In other words, there was overwhelming evidence in the medical school library that the methods being used by doctors were ineffective at best. So So whoever developed the medical school curriculum ignored the scientific literature at every turn. This, to me, was just astounding. I didn't need to go subscribe to some alternative medical journal. I didn't need to go find some natural healing guru somewhere. It was right there in the medical school library. Can you imagine? Can you imagine going to the medical school library and looking up rheumatoid arthritis and diet, and it says a vegan diet followed by 1 week fast cures rheumatoid arthritis? Like, holy cow! They taught me in medical school the diet didn't matter. But all these things are in the medical school library. And if you live in a city that has a medical school library, I just want to let you know, by law, that's LAW, by law, you as a member of the public have access to that library. So you can go to that library, sit down, do incredible searches in their computers, and you should. So this raises another question. Why was the information there? Why was the information, I'll call it the truth, just for lack of a better word, even in the library? And since it was there, why was the information presented in medical school so unbalanced and not at all reflective of what was in the medical school library? Well, as many of you know, I always have these experiences when I talk to other people. So the answer became clear to me when a drug rep visited me one day in my medical office. In the course of conversation, he told me that he had a copy of the PDR that he referred to. He also had a membership in the American Medical Association and got the Journal of the American Medical Association regularly. Well, you can imagine. I was just felt a little impinged upon. I thought that, well, being a member of the AMA, I had privileges and that my journal was private. So I asked him, I said, well, why are you a member of the Medical Association and why do you get the journal? He told me he needed to know what was going on. And in other words, these libraries and books are not there so much for the doctors, but for the big players in healthcare, because they need reliable information in order to do what they're doing to you. In some cases, they need unreliable information, but using their capital, it's called money, they selectively publicize the information to influence people like you and me. That would be doctors and patients. So this begun for me a long history of using .gov websites and the National Library of Medicine. So, the strongest information in support of natural healing is actually in the National Library of Medicine. And nowadays, actually, it's really in the media, because there's such an incredible need to manipulate the feelings of the public to get them to cooperate with certain obviously ridiculous requests of them. So the truth is that the National Library of Medicine, these .gov websites, and these medical libraries are the communication nexus of data that banksters, hospitals, insurance companies, and big pharma rely on in structuring their deals. This is why these sources exist. And so the present system, as it is, requires the collusion of many parties, all of whom need something called deniability. And so all the information is placed in trade journals, the National Library of Medicine, .gov websites, and each party, whether it's the hospital, whether it's Big Pharma, whether it's the government, gets to go there, take the information they need for their purposes, amplify it, slant it, and massage it to influence the behavior of the public for their own personal profit. Occasionally there are conflicts between these parties, but this is basically what's going on. So as a member of the public who is being preyed upon, the information source that you should rely on, if I can use that word, is the data in the National Library of Medicine, the data in medical school libraries, and believe it or not, the data in medical journals. Most of the information, I should say on my part, all of the information that I've gotten about the murders by medicine that to my count, tally 880,000, all of the sources have been .gov sources, have been medical journals. And so this data is there, and you just need to look for it. So let me just say that there's certain information sources you should absolutely not rely on, you should absolutely ignore, and that's any pronouncement from a media source. Well, what does that mean? So if the media announces that we all need to wear gloves and masks tomorrow because of some outbreak or epidemic, that's something you can pretty much dismiss. If the media announces there's a new sexually transmitted disease that makes your thing explode as soon as it touches your partner, you can pretty much dismiss that. So any edict or behavioral directive, just dismiss it. Because that's basically a tertiary information. What does that mean? It means you have something called the facts. That would be primary. Secondary is someone's deduction or reasoning based on that fact. Tertiary is someone else's reasoning based on that reasoning. And then, you know, it gets more and more distracted from there. To put it in basic English, if you've ever played the game Telephone, where you have 20 people sitting in a row, one person whispers a sentence into the person's ear, and it goes from person to person to person. By the time it gets to the end, the signal is so distorted that what the final person gets, that message bears no resemblance to reality. So if you take your direction from public edicts, then you basically have something that bears no resemblance to reality and is actually unrelated to reality. So we're going to talk about some things today, and you'll hopefully get this message. Okay, so the whole, as I said, travesty and murderous details about medicine are in the National Library of Medicine. And it's just that the details are not broadcast on the 6 o'clock news because the news stations don't want to endanger their commercial funding. And this information is not broadcast in the halls of medical schools because medical schools are created and dominated and their curriculum and everything by hospitals and drug companies. So obviously it's not in their interest to broadcast this information. So let's take a look at Ebola because Ebola is a very rich example. So the first level of information that we get, when I say we, I mean the public, and even doctors, the first level of information is pronouncements. A pronouncement example is Ebola is spreading. Next pronouncement, Ebola is deadly. So these are opinions. These are statements of propaganda. How do we find out if they're true? Well, what does it mean to spread? Well, to spread means it's growing and increasing in number. So let's take a look at that. So with Ebola, we've got a very rich history. The first outbreak of Ebola was in 1976. And we have Wikipedia to thank for this source. And according to Wikipedia, Wikipedia tells us that the first outbreak was 1976 in Zaire. 318 cases, 280 deaths. We'll take your word for it. Why not? But a curious thing happens. This is 1976, so this is a 38-year history, right? So we have epidemics going on with death rates of anywhere from 0% to, what's the highest death rate? 90%. Yeah. Okay. So This is 2014, and we are told we have an outbreak, an epidemic of Ebola. All right, sounds good. How many were infected? 4,846 so far. But wait, they've combined this from 5 different countries. So combined, the affected people of 5 different countries only comes down to 4,800. How many dead people? Of course, every death is important, but among these 5 countries, 2,300 died. So we can say, more or less, 600 people per country. Okay. But wait, we have another outbreak later in 2014. Oh, I have to say, I'm sorry, that outbreak spanned a 2-year period, all of 2013 and 2014. So those numbers are substantially lower. So in 2014 alone, we have another outbreak affecting 60 people, okay? So we would say then this epidemic would have peaked, okay? 38 years of this epidemic, and the best it could do was to kill an average of 600 people per country that it infected. This is certainly sad and tragic for the family of those affected and, of course, for those who died. This does not represent anything that's out of control. So let's take a look at the Democratic Republic of the Congo, which is the latest epidemic. Only 60 people were affected. Okay, so let's put this in perspective. It has taken 38 years for this deadly epidemic to reach a peak of 2,375 deaths. And that's over a 2-year period, 2013 and 2014, they counted, to get up to 2,300 deaths. The epidemic, which is in 2014 alone, has only 60 deaths. So it appears to be a sporadic environmental event. In other words, we have several outbreaks happening over a 38-year period. No one epidemic has resulted in the death of more than 500 people, except, of course, the most recent one, but that one spanned 2 years. So we can't really say that an epidemic spanning 2 years killing 600 is more deadly than an epidemic spanning only 1 year that killed 425 people. So then, it's not clear that this epidemic is spreading at all. Now, let's just take a look at another health epidemic that's spreading, and many of you may even be already worried about it. It's Alzheimer's. In 1980, this is the 28-year history now, 28-year history as opposed to 38, in 1980 there were 0 individuals affected. In 1981, there were 2,000 deaths from Alzheimer's in the United States. In 2008, there were 77,100 deaths in the United States from Alzheimer's. Get this. This is a cause of death, whatever it might be, that's increasing steadily. We know it's not genetic because genes haven't shifted that much in this 28-year period. So it's not genetic. Maybe Alzheimer's is infectious. Maybe we should all be wearing masks and wearing condoms to prevent the spread of Alzheimer's. Who knows? Or maybe it's an environmental poison that's being infused into the environment. But obviously something is going on here, and this is surely an epidemic that is spreading because, of course, there's 77,000 deaths. Went from 0 to 77,000 deaths in 28 years. By comparison, Ebola has gone from 280 deaths down to 60 deaths in a 38-year period. So based on these numbers, one cannot say that the Ebola epidemic is spreading. So we can dismiss that piece of information. What else are we told about Ebola? Okay, spreading. Nope, not so. It's deadly. Let's take a look at that. If we look at the Ebola outbreak, when we look at outbreaks plural, we see the death rate for Ebola outbreaks ranges from 0% to a high of 90%, and that the most recent outbreak is about 55%. So while it may be deadly, the deadliness of the infection appears to be extremely variable and dependent upon external factors not relevant to the virus itself. So is the virus deadly? The answer is under certain circumstances. And which circumstances? Well, that has yet to be clarified, but guess what? I looked into this for you because I don't want anyone going away from tonight's show distraught or feeling worried. So the next question about Ebola is, what about treatment? What treatment is available? This is from a reliable source. This is from the Atlanta Emory University. Actually, it's from theguardian.com. And we're going to see what The Guardian has to say about this. Oh, yeah. Okay. So U.S. Ebola victim arrives at Emory University Hospital in Atlanta. And so these are two missionaries, a Dr. Brantley and a Nancy Reitable. Okay, so these are two patients. Now, the article says doctors believe Ebola is passed from wild animals to humans through blood and other bodily fluids. Okay, the word believe means there's no evidence or proof. This is important. There's no evidence or proof of how Ebola is spread. But they believe it's from wild animals to humans. I ask you, those of you listening tonight, when was the last time you encountered the blood and bodily fluids of a wild animal? Not a domestic animal, a wild animal. Yes, tough to come by. You might have seen a wild animal run across your path. But to encounter the blood and bodily fluids of that animal, highly unlikely. All right, so scratch that. If that's the way it's spread, you're safe. And then from human to human contact through bodily fluids. Now, it's important here to read the rest of the article, but I'll summarize it for you. The only way humans to human transmission has been through needles. So, the healthcare worker sticks the patient with the needle and then sticks themselves with the needle. And it's believed there may be cases that have been transferred in that particular manner. All right, so far I think all of the listeners are very, very safe. Now, the virus has no cure or no vaccine. In other words, if you suspect you have it, there is no medication the doctor can give you. And it can kill up to 90% of those infected, depending on the strain, according to the World Health Organization. But wait a minute. Let's find out what really kills people. And to find that out, we can read the rest of the article. Treatment is usually confined to supportive therapy, in which doctors monitor blood pressure and administer intravenous fluids. Let me put this in English for you. They administer water, salt, and potassium. A third-year medical student could do this. And they administer oxygen. Again, third-year medical student. Some experimental treatments have been proven effective in animals, but no treatments are approved for use in humans. So the only treatment for this disease is water, sodium, potassium, plus or minus a little bit of sugar in the water. All right. So far, this is treated just like any case of severe traveler's diarrhea. Yes. How cool is that? So let's look at how contagious this is. So the expert in this article says, I want to underscore that Ebola poses little risk to the U.S. general population, says the head of Center for Disease Control's National Center for Emerging Zoonotic and Infectious Disease. Zoonotic means animal animal related. So these are animal related parasites that this guy studies. So he said this in a press call. While it's clear there's an increased risk for working with patients with Ebola. Now, we covered this in our last show. You get dressed up in a hazmat outfit in the Congo in the heat, and you're going to pass out and die just from excessive perspiration and dehydration. So it's clear there's an increased risk for working with patients with Ebola. So in other words, the patients who have Ebola are not at increased risk of dying. It's those working with those patients who are at increased risk of dying. So how can you catch, how can you have a disease that's more deadly for the healthcare worker than for the patient? So obviously there must be a working condition that's creating the hazard. And we've already identified it as the hazmat outfit itself. Okay, so he's saying we're confident that the standard of care in the United States would prevent much of the transmission if a case were to show up here. Okay, so the standard of care in the United States, we know it's especially deadly. We also know the standard of care is totally powerless in preventing the spread of hospital-acquired infection. So there's no reason to expect the standard of care would be of any protection for anybody. However, since we know that the occupational risk is for healthcare workers, all you have to do is not be a healthcare worker taking care of an Ebola patient. Because if you're taking care of an Ebola patient, they're going to make you get dressed up in a hazmat outfit, and being in a hazmat outfit for an excessive period of time will kill you. So, in other words, unless you're wearing a hazmat suit or purchasing caged exotic animals from Africa, you're pretty safe. But Dr. Jay Varkey, an infectious disease specialist at Emory, has more information for us. He says the hospital's isolation unit was well-equipped to handle patients with diseases even more infectious than Ebola. Okay, key here, even more infectious than Ebola. So Ebola is not very infectious. You don't catch Ebola, or I should say Ebola doesn't catch you. You have to go catch Ebola. You know, you've got to go get an exotic animal. Then the animal, maybe let the animal bite you or cut the animal and rub its blood into a wound or something like that. But in the absence of that level of activity, it's almost impossible for you to get Ebola. Okay, so having been used for treating at least one SARS patient in 2005, and we know, again, the SARS epidemic was also fake, unlike Ebola, SARS is an airborne virus and can spread easily when an infected person coughs or sneezes. So you cannot get Ebola from somebody when they cough or sneeze. In other words, no mask needed. So why the drama of a police escort? Why the drama of workers in hazmat outfits? Why the drama and talk of isolation? Because of the political agenda here, which is not related to the Ebola. The Ebola is a pretense for the political agenda of instituting isolation, of interfering with free movement, either in neighborhoods, in cities, and that's really what's going on here. And this is cute. We have our specialist speaking again. He says, as you might imagine, the kinds of mechanical support and other things available in these clinics in Africa is fairly rudimentary. Now, when you say mechanical support, what we're really talking about is an IV pole and a bag of water, said Monroe. Most of the potential exposure to patients is through needle sticks in collecting specimens and in disposing of bodily fluids if the patients have vomiting or diarrhea. Again, unless an Ebola-infected person is puking on you and having diarrhea all over you, you're really pretty safe here. In other words, the reason people are dying from this epidemic in Africa is because their so-called clinics don't have the ability to measure the proper amount of fluid needed in order to do the proper blood test to see if the potassium is low. They don't have the equipment to measure the fluid as it goes into a person's veins so the person gets the right amount of fluid and not too much or not too little. So, duh, yeah, you're going to have some death. So this is really what we're talking about. We're talking about a situation in another country where they don't have the facilities to treat dehydration. in the United States, you can treat dehydration certainly at any hospital and even at home, actually. And so on Thursday, the CDC has heightened its warning against non-essential travel to Guinea, Liberia, Sierra Leone, where the outbreak is concentrated. And CDC is also assisting with screening passengers before they board planes. Okay, so what does this mean? Read between the lines. The United States government does not want U.S. citizens to see what's happening in Guyana, Liberia, Sierra Leone. There's some kind of secretive operation going on over there, and they don't want unauthorized people going there. Okay, I get it. I'm not buying a ticket to Guinea, Liberia, or Sierra Leone. Now, finally, they close by saying, this is the biggest and most complex Ebola outbreak in history. Far too many lives have been lost already, said the CDC director. And again, like I say, if we prorate the two-year epidemic that they're counting now over a one-year period, it actually isn't any different from the size of the epidemic on a per-country basis that happened. Let's see what year happened in 2001 in Uganda. So if you compare apples and apples and oranges, then the Uganda outbreak is basically comparable to what the outbreak is they're having today. But again, let's take their word for it. Far too many lives have been lost already, said the CDC director, Dr. Tom Friedan, in a statement, announcing a surge in CDC workers to three African nations. An additional 50 disease control experts will arrive in the region in the next 30 days. It will take many months, and it won't be easy. But Ebola can be stopped, he added. We know what needs to be done. Well, wait a minute. Oh, wait a minute. Not so fast. It's not clear anything needs to be done. What are you going to do? Go and kill all the monkeys? You know, you've got a natural environment there, and people and animals are going to come into contact. And furthermore, people die from dehydration. So what you need to do is put an IV pole with a bag of salt water on every corner. But to say that you need 50 disease control experts, you know, it, based on the information presented in this article, that's actually not. But if there's another political agenda, well, of course, it is the case. Who knows what else they need there? They might need some special mining equipment for rare minerals. I mean, who knows what they're really doing over there? But in terms of Ebola, all you need is a bag of salt water, some potassium, and rehydrate. All right, so I hope that we've answered all, in any and all Ebola-related questions. Oh, we have a question here. Let's see. Hi, you're on the air. You have a question? Okay, so we've got another confusing thing to take a look at. This is a question I got from somebody this past week. This person was considering overseas travel and was told that the Dukoral vaccine was recommended for traveler's diarrhea. And so the question is, should the person take this vaccine for a traveler's diarrhea? Well, I took the liberty of, again, consulting a reliable source. What would that be? That would be the Dukoral package insert. Now, again, the package insert is not there for doctors because doctors don't read them. It's not there for patients because patients don't have access to them. The package inserts are there for the major players, which would be the drug companies, insurance companies, hospital, and government to conduct business based on a database. So, let's take a look at this package insert. Very, very interesting. I'm going to warn you right now. The package insert is 26 pages long. But we're going to go right through it. It's not going to take very long. Now, Dukoral is a vaccine against cholera. So, first of all, what's in the vaccine? It has cholera inactivated with heat, yeah. Cholera inactivated with formaldehyde. Okay, so it's got, you're eating formaldehyde with this. Then, I'm just going to go over the interesting stuff. Then you have recombinant cholera toxin B subunit. Let's put this in English. You have genetically modified protein in the vaccine. Okay. Then you have clinically relevant agents, sodium bicarbonate. So sodium hydrogen hydrogen carbonate. So just one sodium, not two sodiums. And then you have saccharin sodium. So you have an artificial sweetener saccharin. You have formaldehyde. You have genetically modified stuff. And you have hydrogen carbonate, which is basically sodium bicarbonate with one carbonate, not two. Okay. So I tell you a little bit about Dukoral. It's got a nice effervescent granule with a raspberry flavor, so we have artificial flavoring. So you dissolve in a glass of water before adding the vaccine, and the vaccine is supplied with one sachet of sodium hydrogen carbonate. All right, and the reason to take it, of course, is because you would like to prevent traveler's diarrhea. Who should not take it? You should not take it if you're overly sensitive to anything in it, like formaldehyde, and who is not sensitive to formaldehyde. And if you are already having diarrhea or a fever, then you shouldn't take it. And they warn you should take it by mouth. There's some special precautions. But more importantly, you have to go to page 8 before you find out that this vaccine can cause loss of appetite, dehydration, headache, dizziness, drowsiness, insomnia, fainting, breathing symptoms like a cough, diarrhea, can cause diarrhea, abdominal cramps, abdominal pain, vomiting, nausea, sore throat, sweating, rash, joint pain, fever, tiredness, and shivers. What a way to spend your vacation. Now, of course, after they released this and sold it to a few people, they found a few more things. It can cause you to pass gas, cause enlarged lymph nodes, pain, flu-like syndrome, chills, gastroenteritis, which, of course, is what you're trying to prevent, numbness, increased sputum, itchiness, and high blood pressure. And there's some drug interactions, but this is the real clincher. Clincher is this. I had to go to a .gov website to find out this information, but 20 to 60% of people who travel internationally will get traveler's diarrhea. Okay, so if you go on this package insert and you go down to, they tell you how to mix it together, how to take it, but you go all the way down to page 26. And on 26, it tells you that if you're a traveler and you take this vaccine, it will reduce your chances of diarrhea by a mere 23%. 23%. So the vaccine only prevents 23% of travelers' diarrhea. So you take 0.23 times 0.6, only 13.8% of people who take this vaccine at most will benefit. And if you go to the side effect profile, they took this stuff and they gave it to people who were healthy. And when they did this, 40% of these people got nausea, vomiting, diarrhea, and other symptoms. So if you take the vaccine, it's a 13.8% chance that you will avoid diarrhea, 40% chance you will actually be harmed, and, of course, a 46.2% chance you will have been simply defrauded and experience no benefit. Now, it doesn't make sense to place bets on a horse with a 13.8% chance of winning. If you place your bets on things that only have a 13.8% chance of ever happening, you will simply go broke. And if you do this with your health, you will quickly become ill. So that's not gonna work. So the question is, should you take a vaccine for traveler's diarrhea? If you're trying to prevent traveler's diarrhea, probably not. I mean, would you use a condom that has a 13.8% effectiveness rate? Probably not. So that's the end of that. So how do you decide? What do you believe? You always have to go back to source documents. If there's a drug, read the package insert. There's a law that has to put certain things in the package insert. Is that for the protection of patients? Absolutely not. It's for the protection of investors. It's for the protection of lawyers. It's for the protection of hospitals and other drug companies. So it's so that the industry, when they're communicating with each other, they have this information here. Doctors are absolutely discouraged from ever reading a package insert. The print is too small. They have to go through heaven and earth to get one. And then when they read the package insert, they find out that the standard of care for the use of the drug contradicts the package insert. Then they get a real headache because if they're going to obey the package insert, then they can't obey the standard of care. But they have to obey the standard of care in order to get paid, in order to avoid being sued. So which is it going to be? Answer, don't read the package insert. So these package inserts are actually not written for doctors. They're written for really the rest of the industry, for people who are managing and controlling the industry. Okay, so that's one example of a recommended vaccine. A recommended vaccine where the package insert acknowledges at best a 13.8% benefit for those who take it and a 40% harm for those who take it. Now, the harm rate, they compared placebo with the vaccine. And so, of course, the harm rate was the same for both. But what was the placebo? The placebo was the diluent and the vehicle of the vaccine. So it wasn't truly a placebo. And so we can take that harm rate then as just what it is, 40% harm rate. Now, every now and then, people ask me all kinds of outrageous questions that, on the face of it, there really wouldn't be an answer to. Many of you know I'm really getting very busy these days. It's like I'm not able to answer individual questions because I spend so much time answering questions from my subscribers, people who are in one of my programs. But this is a page, this is a question from someone who's not in one of my programs, and so I'm going to answer this question on the show. And the question is, what do you believe and how do you know? And so this person says that they have microcytic colitis, right? That means they have an inflammation of the colon detectable under a microscope. Microcytic colitis. Okay, so this person is, of course, having symptoms, nothing's helped, and so they're going to see another specialist who says, I think you have mastocytic enterocolitis, and I want to do a repeat colonoscopy to check you for mastocytic enterocolitis. And so, of course, the question is, should the person get the second colonoscopy to check for mastocytic enterocolitis? Now, this is something that many people are not aware of, is the standard of care is so freaking confusing and so many contradictions, even doctors don't know. This is a site where doctors are asking questions. The doctors are asking the more important doctors, what's going on here? What's really happening? So this guy is saying that, how do I manage mastocytic enterocolitis? How do I manage it, and what should I do with it? If I'm a 50-year-old female with blah, 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 blah. Okay. But the point is, the person has mastocytic enterocolitis, and the question is there anything else I can offer her because the therapy presently is not working? And so the head honcho expert, Phil Lieberman, MD, is answering the questions. And so what he's saying is, thank you for your inquiry. The term was fairly recently coined. In other words, it was made up to describe patients with intractable diarrhea who had what the authors interpreted as increased number of mast cells in the colon and lower duodenum. Oh, time out, time out. So what's increased mast cells? For those of you who don't know, these are cells that are visible under the microscope. So this is microscopic, you got it, colitis. So mastocytic enterocolitis is the same as microscopic colitis because it's an inflammation of the colon. And enterocolitis is just a fancy word. When you think you need more syllables than colitis, you just call it enterocolitis because that means the intestine and colitis. So it's really the same thing. It's redundant. But the point is, she's gone to this doctor and says, I went to Dr. A. He says I have microcytic colitis. Dr. B says, you know what? I think you really have mastocytic enterocolitis. And I want to do another look up there with a tube because I think your insurance will pay for it. Well, really what he's telling her is, oh, I think you have the same thing the other guy says you have, but I want to do a colonoscopy and take a look up there because I think I might be able to add another syllable to your label, even though, of course, it's the same thing. And so this person says, the expert, the head honcho says, mast cells in the colon and lower abdomen. I might mention parenthetically that, according to your inquiry, your patient's biopsy was obtained of its little other. Okay, other authors began to issue follow-up studies, and the condition, to the best of my knowledge, is now accepted as a distinct entity. So the doctors got together and decided that, okay, we're going to make mastocytic enterocolitis different from microcytic enterocolitis. And so one of the lead articles of this acceptance was published 4 years ago, and also treatments that have been used in the attempt to control the symptoms. These treatments are, again, treatments that have been used in the attempt to control the symptoms. Evidently, none of these has been universally effective. But all of these are considered potentially useful. That's really ominous. In other words, there's 5 different ways a doctor could treat this, none of which have been effective. Okay. So this lady is looking at getting a test that will simply rename a condition that she already has and give the doctor the ability to offer therapy that's ineffective. And so this is how you figure out what to believe. So you never believe hearsay. Never, ever, ever believe hearsay. But the doctor says, hey, I think you have blah, blah, blah. You know, it's 2014. You can always go to the internet. And I think it's absolutely awesome that you can listen in on these conversations doctors are having with each other. They say, you know what? We just made this condition up in the past year. The therapies are all totally ineffective. But, hey, go for it. So this is how you decide what to believe. You have to go back to the documents that doctors have access to, that doctors rely on, and that institutions rely on for making decisions. Because they actually have created laws that these documents have to contain factual information. Because, again, there's trillions of dollars riding on this. You know, the healthcare industry, I think, in 2013 was $3 trillion. So this is big bucks. And so this information has got to be factual. And so that's where you go. You go to the information that Wall Street is using to place its bets. And now, your interpretation of the information may not be the same as their interpretation of the information. Now, if I was a Wall Street banker, I'm telling you, I'd take a look at this, and I'd say, oh, man, oh, man, oh, man. Let's see, if I can get 50,000 people to believe that they have mastocytic enterocolitis, then, you know, you could just look at this. How much H1, H2 antihistamines could I sell? How much chromium sodium could I bet on? How much anti-leukotriene agents? How much swallowed Bunesidone in doses of 9 milligrams daily could I sell? And you just add it up, figure it out, and it lets you know what company to invest in next. And so that's how those guys use the information. But for listeners here who have a perspective of trying to preserve or improve their health, what you could take a look at and say, hey, for me to already have the diagnosis of microcytic colitis, it makes no sense for me to submit to the increased risk of shoving a tube up my butt to get a diagnosis that's equally mysterious, having no effective therapy available. So that is a way that you make these decisions. If we have a few more minutes, I'd like to turn my attention to coconut oil. Yes, coconut oil. Now, again, really important. So where do you look? Where do you look for information on these things? Why do you go look in the medical literature? Is it coconut oil? And what do you find? You find nothing. Nothing. Absolutely nothing. What does that tell you? They made it up. They made it up. But now, even if you look at coconut oil in terms of what research has been done, the little bit of research that's been done has been on a basic science molecular basis, not on give somebody coconut oil, you know, two groups of people, give this group coconut oil, don't give that group coconut oil, and see what happens. Those studies have not been done. And my experience with coconut oil, in terms of using it, I'm personally not an oil fan, but I put it on my skin, and I noticed that I did not get the results I was hoping for. So definitely always check to see if they really happen in these studies. Does that mean coconut oil is no good? Absolutely not. It just means that right now it's a faith-based practice. Okay, so coconut oil. If you can't afford it, don't worry about it. If you can afford it, you may still not need to worry about it. Let's take a look at another. This is my favorite. Yeah, another chance to take a controversial stand on things. All right, so genetically modified organisms. We're all aware that a lot of our food is being genetically modified. Many people, myself included, are of the opinion that genetically modified food is not healthy. And so many people try to avoid eating genetically modified food. Now, there are those people who would tell us that genetically modified crops are going to take over the world. They're going to take over the world, and they're going to genetically contaminate the real stuff. And so let's see what we have here. So if we look at crop yields of genetically modified crops, we find that the crop yields are lower. And we can look at an expert from India who actually is totally against genetically modified organisms, and this is what she says. What many fail to realize is that it's the genetically engineered seeds that fail, especially the cotton. And genetically engineered seeds must be repurchased every year. You're not allowed to... Okay, so let's just stop right there. So if you have a seed that cannot germinate from year to year, it's going to select itself out of the food chain. And the other wild varieties or non-genetically engineered varieties are simply going to take over. So without continual cultivation, without purchasing new seed every single year, the genetically modified stuff cannot persist. Now, they also say it requires more water, more pesticides to maintain genetically modified crops. So then what we can see, obviously, is that these crops cannot compete with regular crops. And so unless Monsanto or whoever puts out this stuff is going to run around the world fertilizing and watering and applying pesticides to this stuff, it's just going to fall of its own weight. Yes, it would be nice to have GMO stuff labeled. But the truth of the matter is, what most people are doing, people who have a choice, is they're just growing their own food. And now there are portable growers you can put in your living room, but you can grow your own lettuce and kale and basic vegetables. And I really think that that's where things are going. I think to attempt to regulate an industry that has such an incredible grip on our politicians is simply fruitless. People need to man up and vote with their dollars. Not only their dollars, with their behavior, and simply not rely on these unreliable food sources. And so you can't rely on someone for food if they have a commitment to making you sick. Okay, so let's take a look at questions. Let's say, do I have any announcements? I think we're continuing our sale on discovery sessions. We have a chance to talk with me one-on-one about a particular health concern that you have, and a chance for you to get some clarity on your health concern and plan moving forward, and for us to decide if we'd like to work together any further or not. So for that, you go to vitalitycapsules.com. I don't accept any more than 20 people at any one time, and at the moment I have 17. But in any case, you would certainly get some, I think, very valuable information from the experience. Okay, so we have time to answer a question. Someone is saying, what is the deal with Obama sending 3,000 troops to fight Ebola? Okay, again, so the troops are not there to fight Ebola. The troops are there to restrict the movement of citizens. The troops are there to secure the land and take it from the people. That's what troops do. And so this Ebola, if you want to call it that, is simply a cover story for the decision to deprive these citizens of property, life, and liberty. And that's really about the size of it for the Ebola epidemic. It has no significance in terms of the health. Okay, that is it for tonight. I think that we have got it covered, and we'll see you back again next week.